This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Man in the Queue by Josephine Tay, narrated by Jennifer M. Dixon. Chapter 1. Murder. It was between 7 and 8 o'clock on a March evening, and all over London the bars were being drawn back from pit and gallery doors. Bang, thud, and clank. Grim sounds to preface an evening's amusement. But no last trump could have so galvanized the weary attendants on Thespis and Terpsichore, standing in patient column of four before the gates of promise. Here and there, of course, there was no column. At the Irving, five people spread themselves over the two steps and sacrificed in warmth what they gained in comfort. Greek tragedy was not popular. At the Playbox, there was no one. The Playbox was exclusive and ignored the existence of pits. At the Arena, which had a 3 weeks ballet season, there were 10 persons for the gallery and a long queue for the pit. But at the Woffington, both human strings tailed away, apparently into infinity. Long ago, a lordly official had come down the pit queue, and with a gesture of his outstretched arm that seemed to guillotine hope, had said, "All after here, standing room only." Having thus, with a mere contraction of his deltoid muscle, separated the sheep from the goats, he retired in Olympian state to the front of the theatre, where beyond the glass doors there was warmth and shelter. But no one moved away from the long line. Those who were doomed to stand for 3 hours more seemed indifferent to their martyrdom. They laughed and chattered and passed each other sustaining bits of chocolate in torn silver paper. Standing room only, was it? Well, who would not stand and be pleased to in the last week of Didn't You Know? Nearly 2 years it had run now, London's own musical comedy, and this was its swan song. The stalls on the Circle had been booked up weeks ago, and many foolish virgins, not used to queues, had swelled the waiting throng at the barred doors because bribery and corruption had proved unsuccessful at the box office. Every soul in London, it seemed, was trying to crowd into the Woffington to cheer the show just once again, to see if Golly Gollan had put a new gag into his triumph of foolery. Gollan, who had been rescued from a life on the road by a daring manager and had been given his chance and had taken it. To sun themselves yet once more in the loveliness and sparkle of Ray Markable, that comet that 2 years ago had blazed out of the void into the zenith and had dimmed the known and constant stars. Ray danced like a blown leaf, and her little aloof smile had killed the fashion for dentifrice advertisements in 6 months. Her indefinable charm, the critics called it, but her followers called it many extravagant things, and defined it to each other with hand-wavings and facial contortions when words proved inadequate to convey the whole of her fairy quality. Now she was going to America, like all the good things, and after the last 2 years, London, without Ray Markable, would be an unthinkable desert. Who would not stand for ever just to see her once more? It had been drizzling since 5 o'clock, and every now and then a light, chill air lifted the drizzle and half-playfully swept the queue from end to end with it in one long brush-stroke. That discouraged no one. Even the weather could not take itself seriously tonight. It had merely sufficient tang to provide a suitable aperitif to the fare in front of them. The queue twiddled its toes, and Cockney-wise made the most of whatever entertainment provided itself in the dark canyon of the lane. First, there had come the newsboys, small things with thin, impassive faces and wary eyes. They had flickered down the queue like wildfire and disappeared, leaving behind a trail of chatter and fluttering papers. Then, a man with legs shorter than his body, laid a ragged strip of carpet on the damp pavement and proceeded to tie himself into knots until he looked as a spider does when it is taken unawares, his mournful toad's eyes gleaming now and then from totally unexpected places in the writhing mass, so that even the most indifferent spectator felt his spine trickle. He was succeeded by a man who played popular airs on the fiddle, happily oblivious of the fact that his E string was half a tone flat. Then, simultaneously, came a singer of sentimental ballads and a syncopated orchestra of three. After they had scowled at each other for a moment or two, the soloist tried to rush things on the possession being 9 points principle by breaking into a wailing, "Because you came to me," but the leader of the orchestra, handing his guitar to a lieutenant, proceeded to interview the tenor with his elbows out and his hands lifted. The tenor tried to ignore him by looking over his head, but found it difficult because the musician was half a head taller than himself and appeared to be ubiquitous. He persevered for another 2 lines, and then the ballad wavered uncertainly into bitter expostulation in his natural voice, and 2 minutes later he faded up the dark alley, mumbling threats and complaints, and the orchestra broke into the latest dance tune. This being more to the taste of the moderns than inappropriate resurrection of decayed sentiment, they promptly forgot all about the poor victim of force majeure, and twiddled their toes in time to the lively measure. After the orchestra, and severally, came a conjurer, an evangelist, and a man who allowed himself to be tied up in a rope with imposing-looking knots, and, as imposingly, worked himself free. All these did their little turn and moved on to another performance elsewhere, and each one, before leaving, made a tour of the line, thrusting limp but importunate headgear into the meagre interstices of the queue, and saying, "Thank you, thank you," as encouragement to the bountiful. By way of punctuation to the programme, there had been vendors of sweetmeats, vendors of matches, vendors of toys, vendors even of picture postcards, and the crowd had parted good-naturedly with their pence and found amusement sufficient to their needs. Now a shudder ran down the line, a shudder that the experienced recognised as but one thing. Stools were given up or folded into handbags, food disappeared, purses appeared. The doors were open. The lovely, exciting gamble had begun. Was it to be win, place, or lose by the time they came to the wicket? Up in the front of the queue, where the order was less mathematically 2 and 2 than down in the open, the excitement of the door opening had for a moment or two overcome the habitual place-keeping instincts of the Englishman. I say Englishman advisedly. The Scot has none of it. And there had been a mild pushing and readjustment before the queue had become immobile, in a wedged and short-breathing mass before the guichet, which was immediately inside the pit door. The clink and rattle of coin on brass proclaimed the continual hurried transactions which made the lucky ones free of paradise. The very sound of it made those behind strain forward unconsciously, until the crowd in front protested as audibly as their crushed lungs permitted, and a policeman went down the queue to remonstrate.
Now then, stand back a bit. There's plenty of time. You won't get in by pushing. All in good time."
Now and then the whole line tottered forward a few inches as the emancipated ones ran in 2s and 3s from the head of it, like beads rolling from a broken string. Now a fat woman held them up by fumbling in her bag for more money. Surely the fool could have found out before now the exact amount required, instead of keeping them back like this. As if conscious of their hostility, she turned to the man behind her and said angrily,
"Here, I'll thank you to stop shoving. Can't a lady be allowed to take out her purse without everyone losing their manners?"
That the man she addressed took no notice. His head was sunk on his chest, Only the top of his soft hat met her beady, indignant gaze. She snorted, and moving away from him to face the box office squarely, laid down the money she had been searching for. And as she did so, the man sank slowly to his knees, so that those behind almost fell over him, stayed like that for a moment, and then keeled still more slowly over on his face. "Chap fainted," said someone. No one moved for a moment or two. Minding one's own business in a crowd today is as much an instinct of self-preservation as a chameleon's versatility. Perhaps someone would claim the chap, but no one did. And so a man with more social instinct or more self-importance than the rest moved forward to help the collapsed one. He was about to bend over the limp heap when he stopped, as if stung, and recoiled hastily. A woman shrieked three times horribly, and the pushing, heaving queue froze suddenly to immobility. In the white, clear light of the naked electric in the roof, the man's body, left alone by the instinctive withdrawal of the others, lay revealed in every detail. And rising slantwise from the grey tweed of his coat was a little silver thing that winked wickedly in the baleful light. It was the handle of a dagger. Almost before the cry of "Police!" had gone up, the constable had come from his job of pacification at the other end of the queue. At the first of the woman's shrieks he had turned. No one shrieked like that, except when faced by sudden death. Now he stood looking for a moment at the picture, bent over the man, turned his head gently to the light, released it, and said to the man at the guichet, "Phone for the ambulance and the police." He turned his rather shocked gaze on the queue. "Anyone here know the gentleman?" But no one claimed acquaintance with the still thing on the floor. Behind the man there had been a prosperous suburban couple. The woman was moaning continuously and without expression.
"Oh, let's go home, Jimmy. Oh, let's go home."
On the opposite side of the guichet stood the fat woman, arrested by this sudden horror, grasping her ticket in her black cotton gloves, but making no effort to secure a seat now that the way lay open to her. Down the waiting line behind, the news went like fire in stubble. A man had been murdered, and the crowd in the sloping vestibule began to mill suddenly in hopeless confusion as some tried to get away from the thing that had spoiled all thought of entertainment, and some tried to push forward to see, and some indignant ones fought to keep the place they had stood so many hours for.
"Oh, let's go home, Jimmy. Oh, let's go home."
Jimmy spoke for the first time. "I don't think we can, old girl, until the police decide whether they want us or not." The constable heard him and said, "You're quite right there. You can't go. You first six will stay where you are. And you, missus," he added to the fat woman. "The rest, come on." And he waved them on as he would wave the traffic past a broken-down car. Jimmy's wife broke into hysterical sobbing, and the fat woman expostulated. She had come to see the show and didn't know anything about the man. The four people behind the suburban couple were equally reluctant to be mixed up in the thing they knew nothing about, with results that no one could foresee. They too protested their ignorance. "Maybe," said the policeman, "but you'll have to explain all that at the station. There's nothing to be scared of," he added for their comfort, and rather unconvincingly in the circumstances. So the queue came on. The doorkeeper brought a green curtain from somewhere and covered up the body. The automatic clink and rattle of coin began again and went on, indifferent as rain. The doorkeeper, moved from his habitual Jovian abstraction by their plight, or by the hope of reward, offered to keep their rightful seats for the seven derelicts. Presently came the ambulance and the police from Galbridge Police Station. An inspector had a short interview with each of the detained seven, took names and addresses, and dismissed them, with a warning, to be ready to come up if called upon. Jimmy took his sobbing wife away to a taxi, and the other five straggled soberly into the seats over which the doorkeeper was brooding, just as the curtain rose on the evening performance of Didn't You Know? Chapter 2 Inspector Grant. Superintendent Barker applied a carefully manicured forefinger to the ivory bell-push on the underside of his table, and kept it there until a minion appeared. "Tell Inspector Grant that I want to see him," he said to the minion, who was doing his best to look obsequious in the great man's presence, but was frustrated in his good intention by an incipient embonpoint which compelled him to lean back a little in order to preserve his balance, and by the angle of his nose which was the apotheosis of impudence. Bitterly conscious of failure, the minion withdrew to deliver the message and to bury the memory of his confusion among the unsympathetic perfection of files and foolscap from which he had been summoned, and presently Inspector Grant came into the room and greeted his chief cheerily as one man to another, and his chief's face brightened unconsciously in his presence. If Grant had had an asset beyond the usual ones of devotion to duty and a good supply of brains and courage, it was that the last thing he looked like was a police officer. He was of medium height and slight in build, and he was, now, if I say dapper, of course you will immediately think of something like a tailor's dummy, something perfected out of all individuality, and Grant is most certainly not that. But if you can visualize a dapperness that is not of the tailor's dummy type, then that is Grant. Barker had for years striven unsuccessfully to emulate his subordinate chic. He succeeded merely in looking too carefully dressed. He lacked the flair for things sartorial, as he lacked flair in most things. He was a plodder, but that was the worst that could be said about him. And when he started plodding after someone, that someone usually wished he had never been born. He regarded his subordinate now with an admiration untinged with any resentment, appreciated his son of the morning atmosphere. He himself had been awake most of the night with sciatica, and came to business. "Galbridge are very sick," he said. "In fact, Gow Street went so far as to insinuate that it was a conspiracy." "Oh? Someone been pulling their legs?" "No, but last night's affair is the fifth big thing in their district in the last 3 days, and they're fed up. They want us to take this last affair over." "What is that? The Theatre Q business, is it?" "Yes, and you are OC Investigations, so get busy. You can have Williams. I want Barber to go down to Berkshire about that Newbury burglary. The locals down there will want a lot of soft soap because we have been called in, and Barber is better at that than Williams. I think that is all. Better get down to Gow Street right away. Good luck." Half an hour later, Grant was interviewing the Gowbridge police surgeon. Yes, the surgeon said, the man had been dead when he was brought into hospital. The weapon was a thin, exceedingly sharp stiletto. It had been driven into the man's back on the left side of the backbone with such force that the hilt had pressed his garments to a wad which had kept any blood from flowing. What had escaped had oozed out round the wound without coming to the outer surface at all. In his opinion, the man had been stabbed a considerable time, perhaps 10 minutes or more, before he had collapsed as the people in front moved away. In a squash like that he would be held up and moved along by the crowd. In fact, it would have been a sheer impossibility to fall, if one had wanted to, in such a closely packed mob. He thought it highly unlikely that the man was even aware that he had been struck. So much pressing and squeezing and involuntary hurting went on these occasions, that a sudden and not too painful blow would not be noticed. And about the person who stabbed him, anything peculiar about the stabbing?
No, except that the man was strong and left-handed.
Not a woman.
No, it would need more strength than a woman has to drive the blade in as it has been driven. You see, there was no room for a back sweep of the arm. The blow had to be delivered from a position of rest. Oh, no, it was a man's work, and a determined man's, too.
"Can you tell me anything about the dead man himself?" asked Grant, who liked to hear a scientific opinion on any subject.
"Not much. Well-nourished, prosperous, I should say.
Intelligent?"
"Yes, very, I should think."
"What type?"
"What type of occupation, do you mean?"
"No, I can deduce that for myself. What type of temperament, I suppose you'd call it?"
"Oh, I see." The surgeon thought for a moment. He looked doubtful at his interlocutor.
"Well, no one can say that for a certainty. You understand that."
And when Grant had acknowledged the qualification, "But I should call him one of the lost cause type." He raised his eyebrows interrogatively at the inspector, and, assured of his understanding, added, "He had practical enough qualities in his face, but his hands were a dreamer's. You'll see for yourself." Together they viewed the body. It was that of a young man of 29 or 30, fair-haired, hazel-eyed, slim, and of medium height. The hands, as the doctor had pointed out, were long and slim, and not used to manual work.
"Probably stood a lot," said the surgeon with a glance at the man's feet, "and walked with his left toe turned in."
"Do you think his assailant had any knowledge of anatomy?" asked Grant. It was almost incredible that so small a hole had let a man's life out.
"It wasn't done with the precision of a surgeon, if that's what you mean. As for a knowledge of anatomy, practically everyone who was old enough to have lived through the war has a working knowledge of anatomy. It may have been just a lucky shot, and I rather think it was."
Grant thanked him and came to business with the Gow Street officials. On a table were laid out the scanty contents of the man's pockets. Grant was conscious of a faint dismay when he saw their fewness: a white cotton handkerchief, a small pile of loose change, 2 half-crowns, 2 sixpences, 1 shilling, 4 pennies, and 1/2, and, unexpected, a service revolver. The handkerchief was well worn, but had no laundry mark or initial. The revolver was fully loaded. Grant examined them in a disgusted silence.
"Laundry marks on his clothes?" he asked.
No, there were no marks of any kind, and no one had come to claim him, nor even anyone to make inquiries. No, no one but that old mad woman who laid claim to everyone the police found. Well, he would see the clothes for himself. Painstakingly, he examined each article of clothing. Both hat and shoes were well worn, the shoes so much so that the maker's name, which should have been on the lining, had been obliterated. The hat, when new, had been bought from a firm who owned shops all over London and the provinces. Both were good of their kind, and though well worn, neither was shabby. The blue suit was fashionable, if rather too pronounced in cut, and the same might be said of the grey overcoat. The man's linen was good, if not expensively so, and the shirt was of a popular shade. All the clothes, in fact, had belonged to a man who either took an interest in clothes or was accustomed to the society of those who did. A salesman in a men's outfitters, perhaps. As the Gowbridge people had said, there were no laundry marks. That meant either that the man had wanted to hide his identity, or that his linen was washed habitually at home. Since there was no sign of any obliteration of marks, it followed that the latter was the reasonable explanation. On the other hand, the tailor's name had been deliberately removed from the suit. That and the scantiness of the man's belongings pointed certainly to a desire on his part to conceal his identity. Lastly, the dagger. It was a wicked little weapon in its viperish slenderness. The handle was of silver, about 3 inches long, and represented the figure of some saint, bearded and robed. Here and there it was touched with enamel in bright primitive colours, such as adorn sacred images in Catholic countries.
In general, it was of a type fairly common in Italy and along the south coast of Spain. Grant handled it gingerly. "How many people have had their hands on it?" he asked. The police had commandeered it as soon as the man had arrived in hospital and it could be removed. No one had touched it since, but the expression of satisfaction was wiped from Grant's face when the information was added that it had been tested for fingerprints and had been found blank. Not even a blurred one spoiled the shining surface of the smug saint. "Well," said Grant, "I'll take these and get on." He left instructions with Williams to take the dead man's fingerprints and to have the revolver examined for peculiarities. To his own sight, it seemed to be an exceedingly ordinary service revolver, of a type which since the war has been as common in Britain as Grandfather Clark's. But, as has been said, Grant liked to hear authorities on their own subject. He himself took a taxi and spent the rest of the day interviewing the seven persons who had been nearest the unknown when he collapsed the previous night. As the taxi bore him hither and thither, he let his thought play round and over the situation. He had not the faintest hope that these people he interviewed would be of use to him. They had one and all denied any knowledge of the man when first questioned, and they were not likely to alter their minds as to that now. Also, if any of them had seen a companion with the dead man previously, or had noticed anything suspicious, they would have been only too ready to say so. It was Grant's experience that 99 people proffered useless information where one was silent. Again, the surgeon had said that the man had been stabbed some time before it had been noticed, and no assassin was going to stay in the immediate neighbourhood of his victim until the deed was discovered. Even if the possibility of a bluff had occurred to the murderer, the chances of a connection between himself and his victim being established were too good to allow a sensible man, and a man bent on self-preservation is usually shrewd enough, to indulge in it. No, the man who did it had left the queue some time before. He must find someone who had noticed the murdered man before his death and had seen him in converse with someone. There was, of course, the possibility to be faced that there had been no converse, that the murderer had merely taken up a place behind his victim and slipped away when the thing was done. In that case, he had to find someone who had seen a man leave the queue. That should not be difficult. The press could be called to help. Idly, he considered the type of man it would be. No thorough Englishman used such a weapon. If he used steel at all, he took a razor and cut a person's throat. But his habitual weapon was a bludgeon, and failing that, a gun. This was a crime that had been planned with an ingenuity and executed with a subtlety that was foreign to an Englishman's habit of thought. The very femininity of it proclaimed the Dago, or at the very least, one used to Dago habits of life. A sailor, perhaps. An English sailor used to the Mediterranean ports might have done it. But then, would a sailor have been likely to think of anything so subtle as the queue? He would have been more likely to wait for a dark night and a lonely street. The picturesqueness of the thing was Latin. An Englishman was obsessed with the desire to hit. The manner of the hitting did not habitually concern him. That made him think of motive, and he considered the more obvious ones: theft, revenge, jealousy, fear. The first was ruled out. The man's pockets could have been picked half a dozen times by an expert practitioner in such a crowd, without any more violence than a fly bestows in alighting. Revenge or jealousy? Most probably. Dagos were notoriously vulnerable in their feelings. An insult rankled for a lifetime. A straying smile on the part of their adored, and they ran amok. Had the man with the hazel eyes—he had undoubtedly been attractive—come between a Dago and his girl? For no reason whatever, Grant did not think so. He did not for a moment lose sight of the possibility, but he did not think so. There remained fear. Was the fully loaded revolver prepared for the man who slid that sliver of steel into the owner's back? Had the dead man intended to shoot the Dago on sight, and had the assassin known it and lived in terror? Or was it the other way about? Was it the dead man who had carried a weapon of defense which had not availed him, but then there was the unknown man's desire to slough his identity? A loaded revolver in these circumstances pointed to suicide. But if he contemplated suicide, why postpone it while he went to the play? What other motive induced a man to make himself anonymous? A brush with the police? Arrest? Had he intended to shoot someone, and, afraid of not getting away, made himself nameless? That was possible. It was fairly safe, at least, to suppose that the dead man and the man whom Grant had mentally christened the Dago had known each other sufficiently well to knock sparks from each other. Grant had very little belief in secret societies as the origins of picturesque murders. Secret societies delighted in robbery and blackmail and all the more squalid methods of getting something for nothing, and there was seldom anything picturesque about them, as he knew from bitter experience. Moreover, there were no impressive secret societies in London at present, and he hoped they would not start. Murder, to order, bored him stiff. What interested him was the possible play of mind on mind, of emotion on emotion, like the Dago and the unknown. Well, he must do his best to find out who the unknown was. That would give him a line on the Dago. Why had no one claimed him? It was early yet, of course. He might be recognized by someone at any minute. After all, he had only been missing to his people for the space of a night, and not many people rush to see a murdered man because their son or brother has stayed out for the night. With patience and consideration and an alert mind, Grant interviewed the seven people he had set out to see, quite literally to see. He had not anticipated receiving information from them directly, but he wanted to see them for himself and to sum them up. He found them all going about their various business, with the exception of Mrs. James Ratcliffe, who was prostrate in bed and being attended by the doctor, who deplored the nervous shock she had received. Her sister, a charming girl with hair the colour of honey, talked to Grant. She had come into the drawing-room quite obviously hostile to the thought of any police officer being admitted to her sister in her present state. The sight of the police officer, in reality, was so astonishing that she looked again at his card quite involuntarily, and Grant smiled inwardly, a little more broadly than he permitted himself to outwardly. "I know you hate the sight of me," he said apologetically, and the tone was not wholly acting. "But I wish you would let me talk to your sister for just 2 minutes. You can stand outside the door with a stopwatch, or come in if you like, of course. There is nothing at all private in what I want to say to her. It's only that I am in charge of investigations in this case, and it is my duty to see the seven people who were nearest the man last night. It will help me enormously if I can write them all off the slate tonight and start on fresh lines tomorrow. Don't you see? It's mere form, but very helpful." As he had hoped, this line of argument was a success. After a little hesitation, the girl said, "Let me go and see if I can persuade her." Her report of the inspector's charms must have been a rose-coloured one, for she came back in less time than he had dared to hope, and took him up to her sister's room, where he had an interview with a tearful woman who protested that she had not even noticed the man until he had fallen, and whose wet eyes regarded him continually with a dreadful curiosity. Her mouth was hidden behind a barricade of handkerchief, which she kept pressed to it. Grant wished that she would take it down for a moment. He had a theory that mouths gave away more than eyes, certainly where women were concerned. "Were you standing behind him when he fell?"
"Yes."
"And who was alongside him?" She could not remember. No one was paying attention to anything but getting into the theatre, and in any case she never noticed people on the street.
"I'm sorry," she said shakily, when he was taking his departure. I'd like to be of use if I could. I keep seeing that knife, and I'd do anything to have the man that did it arrested."
And as Grant went out, he dismissed her from his mind. Her husband, whom he had to travel into the city to see — he could have had them all to the yard, but he wanted to see how they were occupying their time on this, the first day after the murder — was more helpful. There had been a fair amount of churning in the queue, he said, as the doors were opened, so that their relations with their neighbours had altered a bit. As far as he could remember, the person who had stood beside the dead man and in front of himself was a man who had belonged to a party of four in front of that again, and had gone in with them. He, like his wife, said that he had not consciously seen the man until he had fallen. The other five Grant found equally innocent and equally unhelpful. None had noticed the man. That amazed Grant just a little. How had no one seen him? He must have been there all the time. One doesn't shove in at the head of a queue without attracting a most uncomfortable amount of attention. And even the most unobservant of people will recall what their eyes have seen, even if they were unconscious of taking notice at the time. Grant was still puzzling when he got back to the yard. There he sent a notice to the press, which asked anyone who had seen a man leave the queue to communicate with Scotland Yard. Also, a full description of the dead man, and as much of the progress of the investigations as was to be given to the public. Then he summoned Williams and demanded an account of his stewardship. Williams reported that the dead man's fingerprints had been photographed, according to instructions, and sent up for investigation, but he was unknown to the police. No corresponding fingerprints were to be found among those betraying dockets. The revolver expert could find nothing individual about the revolver. It was probably second-hand, had been used quite a lot, and was, of course, a very powerful weapon. "Huh," said Grant, disgustedly. "Some expert." And William smiled. "Well, he did say there was nothing distinctive about it," he reminded. And then he explained that before sending the revolver to the experts, he had tested it for fingerprints, and finding quite a lot, had had them photographed. He was now waiting for the prints. "Good man," said Grant, and went in to see the superintendent, carrying the print of the dead man's fingertips with him. He gave Barker a précis of the day's events without adducing any theories about Dagos, beyond remarking that it was a very un-English crime.
"Precious unproductive kind of clues we've got," said Barker.
"All except the dagger, and that's more like something out of a book than part of an honest-to-goodness crime."
"My sentiments exactly," said Grant. "I wonder how many people will be in the Woffington queue tonight," he added irrelevantly. The knowledge of how Barker would have speculated on this fascinating question was lost forever to mankind by the entrance of Williams.
"The revolver print, sir," he said succinctly, and laid them on the table.
Grant picked them up with no great enthusiasm and compared them with the prints he had absent-mindedly been carrying about. After a short time, he stiffened to sudden interest as a pointer stiffens. There were five distinct prints and many incomplete ones, but neither the good prints nor the broken ones had been made by the dead man. Attached to the prints was a report from the fingerprint department. There was no trace of these prints in their records. Back in his room, Grant sat and thought. What did it mean, and of what value was the knowledge? Did the revolver not belong to the dead man? Borrowed, perhaps? But even if it had been borrowed, there would surely have been some indication that the dead man had had it in his possession. Or had the dead man not had it in his possession? Had it been slipped into his pocket by someone else? But one could not slip anything of the weight and bulk of a service revolver into a man's pocket unknown to him. No, not a living man, but it could have been done after the knife thrust. But why? Why? No solution, however far-fetched, presented itself to him. He took the dagger out of its wrappings and considered it through the microscope, but could mesmerize himself into no hopeful state over it. He was stale. He would go out and walk a bit. It was just after 5. He would go down to the Woffington and see the man who had been doorkeeper at the pit last night. It was a fine, still evening with a primrose sky, and London was painted against it in flat washes of a misty lavender. Grant sniffed the air appreciatively. Spring was coming. When he had run the Dago to earth, he would wangle some leave, sick leave, if he couldn't get it any other way, and go fishing somewhere. Where should he go? You got the best fishing in the Highlands, but the company was apt to be darned dull. He would go fishing in the Test, at Stockbridge, perhaps. Trout were poor sport, but there was a snug little pub there, and the best of company. And he would get a horse to ride there, and turf to ride it on. And Hampshire in spring! So he speculated, walking briskly along the embankment, on things far removed from the business on hand. For that was Grant's way. Barker's motto was, "Chew it over. Chew it over continually, sleeping and waking, and you'll find the kernel that matters." That was true for Barker, but not for Grant. Grant had once retorted that when he had chewed to that extent, he couldn't think of anything but the ache in his jaws, and he had meant it. When something baffled him, he found that if he kept on worrying it, he got no further, and lost his sense of proportion in the process. So when he came to a dead stop, he indulged in what he called shutting his eyes for a little, and when he opened them again, he habitually found a new light on things that revealed unexpected angles and made the old problem a totally new proposition. There had been a matinee that afternoon at the Woffington, but he found the theatre in its usual state of shrouded desolation in front and untidy dreariness behind. The doorkeeper was on the premises, but no one was very sure where he was to be found. In the early evening his duties were many and various, it seemed. After several panting messengers had returned from the bowels of the building with reports that, "No, sir, there wasn't a sign of him," Grant himself joined in the exploration and eventually ran the man to earth in a dim passage behind the stage. When Grant had explained who he was and what he wanted, the man became voluble in his pride and eagerness. He was used to being within hailing distance of the aristocracy of the stage, but it was not every day that he had the chance of conversing on friendly terms with that much more august being, an inspector from the CID. He beamed. He continually altered the angle of his cap. He fingered his medal ribbons. He dried his palms on the seat of his trousers, and he quite obviously would have said that he had seen a monkey in the queue if it would have pleased the inspector. Grant groaned inwardly, but the part of himself that always stood aloof, whatever he did, the looker-on part of him, which he had in such abundance, thought appreciatively what a character the old boy was. With that providing for a hypothetical future, which is second nature in a professional detective, he was taking a friendly farewell of so much devoted uselessness, when a charming voice said, "Why, it's Inspector Grant!" And he turned to see Ray Markable in her outdoor things, and evidently on the way to her dressing-room. "Are you looking for a job? I'm afraid you can't have even a walking-on part at this late hour." Her still small smile teased him, and her grey eyes looked at him friendlily from under the slight droop of her lids. They had met a year previously over the theft of a fabulously expensive dressing-case, which had been one of her richest admirer's gifts to her, and though they had not met again since, she had evidently not forgotten him. In spite of himself, he was flattered, even while the looker-on bit of him was aware of it and laughed. He explained his business in the theatre, and the smile faded from her face instantly. "Oh, that poor man!" she said. "But here is another," she added immediately, laying a hand on his arm. "Have you been asking questions all the afternoon? Your throat must be very dry."
Come and have a cup of tea in my room with me. My maid is there, and she will make us some. We are packing up, you know. It is very sad after such a long time."
She led the way to her dressing room, a place that was walled half with mirrors and half with wardrobes, and which looked more like a florist's shop than any apartment designed for human habitation. She indicated the flowers with a wave of her hand.
"My flat won't hold any more, so these have to stay here. The hospitals were very polite, but they said quite firmly that they had had as much as they could do with. And I can't very well say no flowers, as they do at funerals, without hurting people."
"It's the only thing most people can do," Grant said.
"Oh, yes, I know," she said. "I'm not ungrateful, only overwhelmed."
When tea was ready, she poured out for him, and the maid produced shortbread from a tin. As he was stirring his tea and she was pouring out her own, his mind brought him up with a sudden jerk, as an inexperienced rider jabs at his horse's mouth when startled. She was left-handed. "Great heavens," he said to himself, disgustedly. "It isn't that you deserve a holiday, it's that you need it.
What did you want to italicize a statement like that for? How many left-handed people do you think there are in London? You're developing the queerest kind of nerves."
To break the silence, and because it was the first thing that came into his head, he said,
"You're left-handed."
"Yes," she said indifferently, as the subject deserved, and went on to ask him about his investigations. He told her as much as would appear in the morrow's press, and described the knife as being the most interesting feature of the case. "The handle is a little silver saint with blue and red enamel decoration." Something leapt suddenly in Ray Markable's calm eyes.
"What?"
she said involuntarily. He was about to say, "You've seen one like it," but changed his mind. He knew on the instant that she would say no, and that he would have given away the fact that he was aware that there was anything to be aware of. He repeated the description, and she said,
"A saint? How quaint! And how inappropriate! And yet in a big undertaking like a crime, I suppose you'd want someone's blessing on it."
Cool and sweet, she put out her left hand for his cup, and as she replenished it, he watched her steady wrist and impassive manner, and wondered if this too could be unreasonableness on his part. "Certainly not," said his other self. "You may be suffering from attacks of flair in queer places, but you haven't got to the stage of imagining things yet." They discussed America, which Grant knew well, and to which she was about to make her first visit, and when he took his leave, he was honestly grateful to her for the tea. He had forgotten all about tea. Now it wouldn't matter how late he had dinner. But as he went out, he sought a light for his cigarette from the doorkeeper, and in the course of another ebullition of chatter and goodwill, learned that Miss Markable had been in her dressing-room from 6 o'clock the previous evening until the call-boy went for her before her first cue. "Lord Lacing was there," he said, with an eloquent lift of his eyebrow. Grant smiled and nodded and went away, but as he was making his way back to the yard, he was not smiling. What was it that had leapt in Ray Markable's eyes? Not fear, no. Recognition? Yes, that was it. Most certainly recognition. Chapter 3 Danny Miller. Grant opened his eyes and regarded the ceiling of his bedroom speculatively. For the last few minutes he had been technically awake, but his brain, wrapped in the wooliness of sleep and conscious of the ungrateful chilliness of the morning, had denied him thought. But though the reasoning part of him had not wakened, he had become more and more conscious of mental discomfort. Something unpleasant waited him, something exceedingly unpleasant. The growing conviction had dispelled his drowsiness, and his eyes opened on the ceiling, laced across with the early sunlight and the shadows of a plane tree, and on recognition of the unpleasantness. It was the morning of the third day of his investigations, the day of the inquest, and he had nothing to put before the coroner. had not even a scent to follow. His thoughts went back over yesterday. In the morning, the dead man being still unidentified, he had given Williams the man's tie, that being the newest and most individual thing about him, and had sent him out to scour London. The tie, like the rest of the man's clothes, had been obtained from a branch of a multiple business, and it was a small hope that any shop assistant would remember the individual to whom he sold the tie. Even if he did, there was no guarantee that the man remembered was their man. Faith Brothers must have sold several dozens of ties of the same pattern in London alone, but there was always that last odd chance, and Grant had seen too much of the queer unexpectedness of chance to neglect any avenue of exploration. As Williams was leaving the room, an idea had occurred to him. There was that first idea of his that the man had been a salesman in some clothing business. Perhaps he did not buy his things over the counter. He might have been in the employ of Faith Brothers. "Find out," he had said to Williams, "if anyone answering the dead man's description has been employed by any one of the branches lately. If you see or hear anything interesting at all, whether you think it is important or not, let me know." Left alone, he had examined the morning's press. He had not bothered with the various accounts of this Q murder, but the rest of the news he scrutinized with some care, beginning with the personal column. Nothing, however, sounded an answering chord in his brain. A photograph of himself with the caption, "Inspector Grant, who is in charge of the Q murder investigations," caused him to frown. "Fools," he said aloud. He had then collected and studied a list of missing persons sent in from all the police stations in Britain. 5 young men were missing from various places, and the description of one who was missing from a small Durham town might have been that of the dead man. After a long delay, Grant had succeeded in talking on the telephone to the Durham police, only to learn that the missing man had originally been a miner and was, in the opinion of the Durham inspector, a tough. And neither miner nor tough could be applied to the dead man. The rest of the morning had been occupied with routine work, settling about the inquest and such necessary formalities. About lunchtime, Williams had rung him up from the biggest branch of Faith Brothers in the Strand. He had had a busy but unproductive morning. Not only did no one recall such a purchaser, but no one remembered even selling such a tie. It was not one of a range that they had stocked lately. That had made him want further information about the tie itself, and he had come to the headquarters and asked to see the manager, to whom he explained the situation. The manager now suggested that if the inspector would surrender the tie for a little, it should be sent to their factory at Northwood, where a list could be furnished of the destination of all consignments of such ties within, say, the last year. Williams now sought permission to hand over the tie to the manager. Grant had approved his action, and while mentally commending Williams' common sense — lots of sergeants would have gone on plodding round London because they were told to and it was their duty — thought not too hopefully of the 100 or so branches of Faith Brothers all over Scotland and England. The chances narrowed slightly, however, when Williams appeared with a fuller explanation. Ties like that, it appeared, were made up in boxes of 6, each tie in the box being of a different shade, though usually in the same colour scheme. It was unlikely that more than one, or at the most 2, ties of the exact shade of their specimen had been sent to any one branch. There was therefore more hope of a salesman remembering the customer who had bought it than there would have been if the tie had been merely one of a box all the same shade. The detective part of Grant listened appreciatively, while the looker-on part of him smiled over the sergeant's fluency in the jargon of the trade. Half an hour with the manager of Faith Brothers had had the effect of studying the sergeant's habitual simplicity of words and phrases with amazing jewels of technicality. He talked glibly of lines and repeats and similar profundities. so that Grant had, through his bulk, in a queer television, a vivid picture of the manager himself. But he was grateful to Williams and said so. That was part of Grant's charm. He never forgot to say when he was pleased. In the afternoon, having given up hope of learning anything more by it, he had sent the dagger to the laboratory for analysis. "Tell me anything you can about it," he had said, and last night when he left he was still waiting for the answer. Now he stretched out an arm into the chilly air and grabbed at the telephone. When he got the number he had asked for, he said, "Inspector Grant speaking. Any developments?" No, there were no developments. Two people had viewed the body last night, two separate people, but neither had recognized it. Yes, their names and addresses had been taken and were lying on his desk now. There was also a report from the laboratory. "Good," said Grant, jammed the earpiece on the hook and sprang out of bed, his sense of foreboding dispelled by the clear light of reason. Over his cold bath he whistled, and all the time he was dressing he whistled, so that his landlady said to her husband, who was departing to catch an 8 o'clock bus, "I'm thinking it won't be very long now before that horrible anarchist is caught." Anarchist and assassin were synonymous terms to Mrs. Field. Grant himself would not have put it so optimistically, perhaps, but the thought of that sealed package waiting on his desk was to him what a lucky packet is to a small boy. It might be something of no importance, and it might be a diamond. He caught Mrs. Field's benevolent glance on him as she set down his breakfast, and it was like a small boy that he said to her, "This my lucky day, do you think?" "I don't know about luck, Mr. Grant. I don't know as I believes in it, but I do believe in Providence, and I don't think Providence'll let a nice young man like that be stabbed to death and not bring the guilty to justice. Trust in the Lord, Mr. Grant. And if the clues are very thin, the Lord and the CID." Grant misquoted at her and attacked his bacon and eggs. She lingered a moment watching him, shook her head in a gentle, misgiving way at him, and left him scanning the newspapers while he chewed. On the way up to town he occupied himself by considering the problem of the man's non-identification, which became momentarily more surprising. True, a few persons every year are thrown up by London to lie unclaimed for a day or two and then vanish into paupers' graves, but they are all either old or penniless or both, the dregs of a city's being, cast off long before their deaths by their relations and friends, and so, when the end came, beyond the ken of anyone who might have told their story. In all Grant's experience, no one of the type of the dead man, a man who must have had the normal circle of acquaintances, if not more, had remained unidentified. Even if he had been a provincial or a foreigner, and Grant did not think he was, the man's whole appearance had proclaimed the Londoner. He must have had a dwelling in London or near it, hotel, lodgings or club, from which he must now be known to be missing. And the appeals from the press that the fact of a missing person should be communicated to Scotland Yard without delay would most certainly have brought someone hurrying to report it. Then, granted that the man was a Londoner, as Grant most heartily believed, why did his people or his landlord not come forward? Obviously, either because they had reason to think the dead man a bad lot, or because they themselves had no wish to attract the attention of the police. A gang? A gang getting rid of an unwanted member? But gangs didn't wait until they got their victim into a queue before dispensing with his services. They chose safer methods. Unless... yes, it might have been at once a retribution and a warning. It had had all the elements of a gesture, the weapon, the striking down of the victim while in a place of supposed safety, the whole bravado of the thing. It eliminated the backslider and intimidated the survivors at one and the same time. The more he considered it, the more it seemed the reasonable explanation of a mystery. He had scouted the thought of a secret society, and he still scouted it. The vengeance of a secret society would not prevent the man's friends from reporting his loss and claiming him. But the defaulting member of a gang, that was a different thing. In that case, all his friends would either know or guess the manner and reason of his death, and none would be fool enough to come forward. As Grant turned into the yard, he was revising in his mind the various London gangs that flourished at the moment.